Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. This week, backed by popular acclaim, Professor Richard A. Epstein. You'll recall that last week we were discussing with this very prominent lawyer, professor of law, who was voted one of the most eminent legal thinkers and influential legal thinkers in America. We were discussing how to reconcile libertarianism and the law. He's a dyed-in-the-wool libertarian. Well, we got into a very interesting exercise. What if he could go to Blair House with the president-elect in November, or the White House if it's a re-elected incumbent, and have an hour to give him some very good advice, nonpartisan, on 10 things to do from a libertarian perspective in America to make it a better place? What would he say? We did four of those last week, and we liked it so much, we're doing the six other points right now. Here's Professor Epstein. So, Professor Epstein, let's pick up where we left off together in the Oval Office. I'm watching over your shoulder, and the President is listening attentively to your libertarian point of view on 10 major factors in the economy. And you've already given him your point of view on jobs, bailouts, the public debt, and taxes. And now his fifth question is about the currency. What do I do with the currency and the Fed and all that?
Well, essentially, my view about this is I'm not a gold bug, because the amount of gold in an economy can vary, and with it the value of the currency. But I think that one has to go back to the basic monetarist principles of Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, which is the object in that particular system is to try to keep the currency essentially constant relative to the GDP. The importance here is that you want to have a stable currency so that when people enter into private negotiations, they don't have to bargain over the uncertainties as to what the dollar or the pound will be worth at some time in the future. And this means, in effect, that you could simplify contracts vastly. It's much easier to enter into long-term arrangements like mortgages because you have one of the elements of gratuitous uncertainty removed from the type situation. And the second thing that you want to do is, with an institution like the Fed, is remove from their jurisdiction all the collateral things that have been put onto them in recent years. Much of that goes through the Dodd-Frank Act, most of which should be repealed. There's something known as the Durbin Amendment, on which I work, which essentially has the Fed setting regulations for the amount of interchange that could be charged on debit cards. Any price controls over market type arrangements are foolish, and putting the Fed on that just diverts their resources from other things. The basic strategy about government is you want your agencies to do a few things and you want to do them well, but you don't want to create these smorgasbord operations in which a bunch of amateurs keep on bumping into each other's way.
And it strikes me that even though central banks obviously have come a long way from, you know, the 1920s in Germany when they would print at will, things have gotten much better than that, but still in Europe and Japan, they still come under a lot of pressure to do things monetarily, and it's hard to insulate them from that.
It is, particularly if you don't create institutions that will do that. We've done a better job in the United States with the Fed, because for the most part what we've done is create a system of relatively independent members with respect to it. But we still have a lot of problems with banking. Interestingly enough, I recently attended a seminar where it turns out that the most admirable system of banking in the world turns out to be the Canadian. The American system has had repeated bank failures. The Canadian system over a comparable period of time has had a grand total of zero failures. And the key institutional arrangement difference is the American system favored local monopolies in banking by prohibiting branch banks. And this means that the banks were undiversified with respect to the loans that they made and the monies that they received. So if part of the country goes belly up, the bank goes with it. The Canadian banks, there are a number of them, so that there's competition, but they tend to be national so that you don't get yourself into a situation where local situations will bring you down. And, you know, if I had to be the American guy, I would send somebody up to Canada to figure out how to run a banking system. I would not send them up to Canada to see how you run a debit card system, because frankly, it's much too much under government control.
But it's funny, you know, I can remember a time when we were told kind of the opposite. Up here we were told, well, American banks are more tied to their communities because they're smaller and they're rooted. And ours up here are national and kind of too big and kind of shut off from their clientele. It doesn't help entrepreneurs at all. But you're taking the opposite view.
And there are ways in which you can change that. What you do is you have large banks and they create small organizations within them. So what you want is local people to initiate the loans, but you have to be able to get a pool at the bank level, which is a little bit more diversified. And I don't think that that's an argument in favor of this insular system of branch banking, which has plagued the United States for so much, rather these isolated banks. It's a system for intelligent centralized management. And I think the Canadian banks have done a much better job. And you'll note that, you know, the TD Bank in the United States, which seems to be sprouting offices everywhere, is in fact what, the Toronto Dominion Bank or some such thing?
Yeah, Toronto Dominion, yeah.
Okay. I mean, and you know, they've learned well. They did not go through this stuff. And they learn how to separate their asset pools and to figure out what kinds of investments. What we've done in the United States with banking is we've taken the big banks and make them bigger. It is simply untenable to run a banking system where your four largest banks are four times as large or eight times as large as the fifth largest bank. And you really have to try to find a way to spin things out of Bank of America, Citibank, Chase, and even Wells Fargo, which is the smallest of the four.
And then the president looks at you and says, okay, here comes number six. And he knows you're going to be very strict with him on it, because you have the libertarian point of view. So he says, what do I do about regulation?
Well, regulation is a vast subject. And the question is, what are the targets of regulation first? And here I would put it in the following way. Controlling the sorts of, I'm going to use a technical term and then explain it, externalities that were actionable at common law is something you have to take seriously. And what that means is, if you've got a factory that's polluting and throwing things out, private rights of actions by individuals who are aggrieved is just a very inefficient way to deal with it. And so what you want to do is to get a system of direct regulation whose chief objective is to reduce pollution and not to achieve other ends. This turns out to be extremely difficult to do. Just to give one example, right now what we do is we have a very heavy system of regulation with respect to the pollution that comes from new vehicles and new sources under the Clean Air Act in the United States. But we have very weak regulation with respect to existing sources that are not coming online. So this ridiculous permitting process means that we keep forever really dangerous sources while keeping out those which are better. The correct policy is to say, if you could produce $1 million worth of goods with 1,000 tons of pollution under the old system and do it with 1 ton of pollution under the new system, don't keep the new system out because they haven't reduced it to 0.1 ton. You've got to be smart on that stuff, and that's the major stuff. With respect to trade regulation, here the issue is generally monopoly, and I'm just going to give a first approximation of it. The areas where you want to worry about most are cartels, which for the most part create unification without any efficiencies. You got to give a little look with respect to mergers. But the most important thing is not to use the trade laws to create local monopolies for people by knocking out their various kinds of competition. That means you want to relax the barriers with respect to free trade, that is from goods and services coming in overseas. And then for the rest of it, what you try to do is to create a set of rules which allow companies to trade with confidence that their trading partners will in fact honor their obligations, which means you want to be a strong supporter of the voluntary exchanges which allow a large number of traders to come together. On consumer protection, you always have to worry about the issue about fraud, but you got to do it smart. You can't do it dumb. So simple disclosures are the primary targets are what you need. And then again, instead of trying to regulate a few firms and a big firms, you want to encourage entry by smaller firms and to give customers who are in fact built ordinary rights of action, which they could achieve with respect to the torts or with respect to the courts. And with respect to labor regulation, for the most part, there's almost no sensible form of labor regulation in the United States, and you ought to move very aggressively to see if you could dismantle it. Even such sacred targets as the Civil Rights Act of the United States, it does much more harm to poor workers.
Including equal opportunity?
You don't want those things. Equal opportunities laws are a barrier to those people whose skills are less powerful than others. I'm perfectly willing to allow, and indeed I'm in favor of having any private enterprise decide to run whatever kind of job training program, whatever affirmative action program they want, because they're going to be subject to market forces. And what market forces tell you is that the myth that there's something known as a merit good, that is the only thing that matters in a firm, is how many widgets an individual working alone can produce, is false. Teamwork really matters. Balance really matters. And firms are very good at internalizing those soft values. So when, for example, conservatives insist that we must have a colorblind constitution, what they're doing, in effect, is crippling the very kinds of enterprises which understand how these various inputs should be put together. And what we should do, in effect, is to set them free from this stuff. In the government, you have a greater concern about who can be hired. And favoritism is a much larger type of issue here than it is there. But with respect to the private side, you want to deregulate. And with the public side, basically the first rule of thumb is whatever you're going to find is commonly practiced in the private sector ought to be permissible with respect to government entities.
Which brings us very naturally to the president's seventh point in his Oval Office quiz with you. He wants to know the libertarian point of view on labor laws. Do you want him to be tougher on that? Do you want him to have right to work, let's say, as a national standard?
Well, the labor stuff is very complicated. Right to work laws are certainly appropriate. These are the statutes which say that people who work in right to work states are not required to pay union dues even if there's a union shop. But I really think that you want to go much further than that. The greatest problem with respect to unions today is not strikes. They're sufficiently weak in the economic barrier that they can't get them. It is not usually lockouts, although those are on the rise. The real problem with unions is their extraterritorial activity, that is, territorial activity outside the bargaining table. So if you take something in New York City, you have the Kingsbridge Armory situation, in which a developer, a company called Related, wants to put into place a complete revitalization of an obsolete facility. And what the unions come in and they persuade the city council to do is to block this unless these guys are willing to hire union workers or to pay living wages. And when you allow unions to influence zoning boards, when you allow them to influence the way in which trade investigations are going to be made for dumping allegations made against foreign companies, what you're doing is you're inviting a terrible abuse of the political process by putting public people on behalf of unions in these kinds of labor negotiations. This has to stop. To give you another illustration, many unions think that if they want to organize a business, the way in which to do it is to report anonymously to public authorities that these guys are in violation of the health laws, and then send the inspectors out, then have the cameras rolling, and then put it on the television. That kind of behavior is defamation, as far as I'm concerned. False statements about a third person designed to interfere with their ability to engage in trade. You have to be able to stop that. They should be sued for those kinds of activities. If I could.
So if a romantic from the good old days, somebody who idolized unions like Woody Guthrie, if he were alive today or if he came back, would he be shocked at the way they behave today and what they've become?
No, because they were doing this back then. He was blind to the situation. One of my favorite New York Times headlines. It's from 1912, sometime in November, and a union guy was being prosecuted for blowing up a building, and he said he was really a very virtuous guy because he made sure that the buildings next door were emptied of all people before he decided to blow up the building he was going to do. This history of union violence is very strong. It produces employer violence in response, and the reason is that instead of having competition by small entities, unions want to mass, employers then mass on the opposite side, and you get what John Kennedy Galbraith praised as countervailing powers, but it's not something to be praised. It's something to be condemned. You want to create smaller independent unions that are in competition with each other. You want to do it on the labor side, and you want to do it on the management side. One really important reform, I'll just finish on this one, is there was an institution known as the Yellow Dog Contract, which said, in effect, that an employer could say that so long as you work for me, you agree not to join a union and agree not to promise to join a union if you're requested to do so. Those contracts should be made enforceable, because what they do is they enforce competition, and if a worker's really unhappy and wants to join a union, all he has to do is quit.
And go to another company.
Or to another, even join a union. But unions produce nothing, so that in a purely competitive environment, they will essentially be absolutely overwhelmed by a series of strategic contracts, by employers who can give workers what they want and take away from them the heavy overhead in terms of dues and personal obligations that comes with unions. That's why in the United States they've gone from 35% down to 6.2%, and why the president in the United States is unable to boost them. They don't supply things that a market could supply, and they cost a lot more, and they give a lot less.
All right. And then the newly elected or reelected president looks at you, and he's got point number 8 for you, and that's a real headache for him and for you. Congressional gridlock. What's the libertarian point of view?
Oh, I mean, my view about that is until you get some deregulation, gridlock is one of the few things that save a nation. Gridlock means that on average you're going to pass fewer laws, and most of the laws that you're going to pass are going to be unwise. And the whole purpose of an original constitution, which created different houses with different terms of offices and had checks and balances and vetoes, was the presumption that most legislation is bad, and so therefore we want to give it an uphill battle. The irony is that we've managed to create a system where most of the laws on the books are bad, and now it becomes extremely difficult to figure out how to repeal them. So what you'd like to do, in my view, is to relax the checks and balances with respect to repeals, but not with respect to new enactments. And I don't see constitutionally how do you do that.
And you don't worry too much about the gridlock.
Well, I think what you have to do is, I mean, you know, if you're going to be a president, you can't shilly-shally. You can't try to make your public announcements appear that everybody's equally right on every kind of issue. What you have to do is to summon a moral majority and hope that you can, in the short run, persuade people that they're going to be better off if they have a huge package of bills, each of which protects a set of special interests, all of which are abolished simultaneously.
All right. And then the president looks at you and gives you item number 9, the environment.
Well, again, I mean, I sort of hinted at that when I talked about regulation. What you want to do with the environment is to control externalities through the use of government coercion where private individuals can sue. That means that there are a large number of things that you might want to do environmentally which you ought to pay for. So you think that somebody's property is good as a wetland? Fine. Condemn it and use it as a wetland. But the moment you allow people to say, oh, no, no, this guy is interfering with the magical cycle of nature and we don't have to pay him a dime, what you do is you find that a minnow can now travel up a stream and that's probably worth $100, but somebody is no longer going to be able to mine coal out of the area, to cut down timber, do something of the sort, which is going to cost millions. The key thing to understand about government overregulation in the environmental area is if you allow the government to take a lot of resources from private hands at zero price, it will overconsume. I worked on a case once in the state of Michigan in which the issue was whether or not a following piece of land was a wetland which you could stop building on without cost. And this was a prime plot of real estate in the center of a town, and there had been a tractor which had come through and left a bunch of puddles there in the tread marks. And the government comes through, and what they do is they kind of draw circles around all these treads and puddles and announces that they're wetland. And if you could find a 73-shaped object that you could put on this particular thing within those areas, be free to do so. Then what they did is they said, well, you know, we really don't want this land. You go buy us some really good wetlands out somewhere else, and we'll relax this designation. That's just naked coercion. I'm all in favor of the government buying lands. I'm all in favor of private people putting them aside if you pay for it out of public monies. But to trump up a charge of a phony wetland and then exact from a given guy who wants to build on it sums of money that allow you to buy something somewhere else is just a naked form of extortion and should be condemned as such.
But it's so easy to sell that politically because everybody loves clean air, loves clean water.
Well, I love them too, and you can sell them clearly. This is, you make the battle over means, not over ends, when you talk about this. They are using dirty means in order to achieve perfectly legitimate ends, but there are better ways in which you can do it. So use those ends. Use those means to achieve the desirable ends. And if the government wants to condemn a set of pristine lands which has strong environmental values, put it up to the taxpayers. They are now going to have to figure out whether their tax dollars are, in effect, going to be better spent on this or something else, either public or private, and you'll get a decent political process. The thing to understand is you will not get a decent deliberative democracy if the government is allowed to deliberate on how it's going to steal from individuals at zero price. You only get honest public deliberation when the costs are put on the table along with the benefits, and only a system that requires compensation, just compensation, can do that.
And now, Our time in the Oval Office is almost up, and the president is getting to the end of his 10-item list, and he looks at you and says, you're a libertarian. Talk to me about states' rights. Should we devolve? Should the federal government get smaller and devolve to the states?
Well, this turns out to be a very complicated question, and I'm basically in favor, at least in the United States, and I think this also works for Canada as well with the provinces, on the following solution. There is no abstract argument for or against states' rights. States can become demonic and tyrannical with respect to individuals within their borders, and the federal government could create nationwide monopolies. What you have to do is to figure out the problems you're trying to solve and then figure out the level of government that's best able to solve it. So as a first approximation, what you want to do with respect to local productive activities, these little squares I talked about in the last show, is to make those subject to state regulation, but to insist that the state regulation in the form of zoning be subject to a just compensation restraint. So that way you get local knowledge on the one hand, but you don't get the overclaiming that I talked about with respect to environmental stuff on the other hand. When you start talking about those long, skinny threads about railroads and about all sorts of other highways and telecommunications and so forth, the great danger is that the states can blockade so that you could never get a railroad from east to west. And with respect to those kinds of issues, what you generally need to do is to have federal regulation so that the entire network can be put under unitary control. And then if it wants to, it can delegate some fraction of that control of the network, say for local phone calls, to local agencies. The local national decisions and distinction in telecommunications doesn't mean much anymore because everybody has a cell phone. And the first time I realized this is when I was sitting in Colorado and I was calling my daughter who had a New York phone address and I had a Chicago one, and we were 10 feet away on the hill. Right? You know, we're using cell phones, local calls, distance calls, who knows? But when you're doing with pipelines and so forth and railroads and airplanes, at that point the blockade issue is very important, so you need to have the federal government handle that problem. And that's what was done on the original Commerce Clause design in the United States, where it said Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. The whole point among the several states is you cannot let local blockades destroy a common market and trade. And that's the central function of a federal government. But at every stage, you have to be worried about oppression. Local governments oppress, national governments oppress, so structuralism will not solve all your problems. What you need in addition to that are constitutional protections of property rights against their usurpation without just compensation.
And final question, there's a cliche that used to be bandied about decades ago and actually throughout most of history. Whenever a new invention appears, people predict that jobs will disappear and will not come back in equal numbers. And of course, it always turns out to be wrong and silly because after the invention is there, new jobs do appear in completely unforeseen ways. But now people are saying it again, despite that, the lesson of history, people are saying again that the technology we have now is so smart and so efficient that it's eliminating vast numbers of jobs that will not reappear. What do you think of that?
I think it's one of the most bogus and dangerous arguments that you could ever make. Yes, there's going to be a decline in the print medium. But if you take the number of jobs that are now created in the various web-based mediums, that number is going to far exceed them. And then there are support industries that have to take place with respect to them as well. So you never want to do this. I mean, I have a wonderful proposal to create jobs. What you do is you interview telephone operators so that every time you want to make a call, somebody says, what number, please? You could go right back that far. ATM machines, you really want to abolish those because it turns out they allow people to get money at a thing? No, you release that, and if you have accurate labor markets, this is what will happen. Wages will a little bit fall, but the fall in the level of prices will even be greater, so that the aggregate situation will be a higher level of standing of living with respect to everybody. What are you going to do about transitions? Well, the most abrupt transitions tend to take place where you get unions that dig themselves in, find that they lose in these kinds of situations, and then what you do is you have a radical restructuring, a downsizing in a business. You have to get rid of the discontinuities that monopoly bargaining creates in labor markets. You have to do the same thing with respect to real estate development. If you remove the monopoly, remove the government restrictions, try to create a low-tax environment, all this stuff about the doomsday on new technologies will quickly disappear. This is a form of Ludditism, which remember back in the 1819-20 period, the way in which you stopped industrialization in England was to kill all the machines. Well, let me just give you one little statistic. These machines were not around much. By 1850, they start coming in, and then miraculously, by 1900, you see the living, the life expectancy in England goes from 40 to 47 years. And nobody can figure out why, because all they can do is report the atrocities of a laissez-faire economy. But there is a simpler explanation. You think it's bad working in these factories. You happen to read about Murdstone and Grimsby in David Copperfield. Charles Dickens was not a particularly astute thinker on these things. Just look at the aggregate numbers. And how do you explain if there's increased industrialization and greater savagery that it goes up in 7 years more than it has gone up in the previous 500 years? years in England. And the same thing happened in the United States. To give you just another number, a life expectancy in the United States in 1900 was about 47 years. For black people in the United States, the number was about 32 years. You go to 1920, all of a sudden this is up to 54 years. And that includes all of the difficulties with the pandemic after World War I with the influenza virus and so forth. There were immense progresses, and industrialization can do that. You get a rich society, you can control externalities. You get a rich society, you can do the kind of investments that get people to have vitamins. So what's the source of this improvement? Well, you get vitamin A, you don't get pellagra. Vitamin B, you don't get beriberi. Vitamin C, you don't get scurvy. These are killers. And what you need to do is to push very relentlessly a pro-growth program, and what it has done to infant mortality is enormous. And who are the greatest beneficiaries of any major public health improvement? It's, Bob, always the same people. It's those at the bottom of the income distribution. Because if you cut infant mortality in half, if it's poor people there at 60, they go to 30. Rich people go from 10 to 5. One group has gained 30%, the other group has gained 5%. Just keep your eye on the ball and never, ever, ever let people start to tell you that technological progress is a source of danger. It is a source of betterment for everybody in the society at large. And I think that those people who take the opposite position should be castigated publicly for their kind of negativism.
Well, I think that at this point, the president would thank you and maybe would ask you to run on his ticket. That's how impressed he'd be. I'm certainly very impressed, and I thank you as well. It's been great.
My pleasure.
Professor Richard A. Epstein was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of the World Show. And that's our program. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.